crusader, the batfish, along with many other algae-eating fish species, is a true superhero of Australia's Great Barrier Reef. Learn more at islaearth.org. Isla Earth is produced by the Catalina Island Conservancy with support from its Fund for a Sustainable Planet, because Earth is an island.
This week's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Gosh, Johnny, playing in the cave sure is neat.
Oh, boy, a kitty cat.
Sassy, the kitty cat's yelling.
What, Sassy? It's not a kitty? It's a bobcat? Speaking of cats, you like to stress the importance of adopting cats from animal shelters? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year? And with millions of healthy cats to choose from, it's a shame more people don't adopt from shelters.
This bobcat's heavy. Help, Sassy!
Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow?
What's that supposed to mean? Oh, nuts.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
Reveals a kind of pathology that is revolting. I can actually feel the bile in my stomach. That would be in about the middle of my alimentary canal. Churning. That doesn't happen very often. I've been doing this for years. I can listen to Rush Limbaugh for hours at a time. I normally don't feel revulsion, but this is revolting. Wait, and again, if you've been listening to Randy Rhodes, and many of our listeners probably do, but this is for the rest of us who actually can't tune in or don't tune in, can't even get it, as a matter of fact. There are a lot of, now I forget, there are a lot of, I live in a market that actually does have Randy Rhodes on my car radio, and many people don't. Okay, let me get back to here. We were talking about the political expose on the RNC document that mocks donors and plays on the fear of some. In other words, they've divided donors into the haves and have-nots, as Bush put it. Those who I call my base, I call you the have-mores.
No, the haves, we've got two different kinds of people here tonight, the haves and the have-mores. And some people might call you elite. I call you my base.
Thank you for that chilling.
Ding, 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 ding. I'm so freaking glad he's gone.
Thank you for that, recreating that chilling memory for me. But this is the same. Republican National Committee plans to raise money this election cycle through an aggressive campaign capitalizing on fear. We talked about.
I can't believe this is shocking you. Because fear? Republicans? Never.
Now, listen to this. Listen to this. This, because they have gone from, and the article points it out, the strategy was detailed in a confidential party fundraising presentation, which Politico obtained, and outlines how ego-driven.
America! I'll bring you France, Germany, UK! America! Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia. Conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Hey, and welcome to the program. Welcome to Friday on the Front Porch. It's been a beautiful day here in the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful, almost level West by God, Virginia. I'm Bob, and I'm Bob for the last time for several days now, as I will be gone to Washington, D.C. next week to do some lobbying work on behalf of myself, my family, my community, my beloved state, these beloved Appalachian Mountains. It is, I consider it a moral duty to do what I'm doing. So I will not be on the air next week at all. And let me explain, I will be arriving home probably on Thursday, probably not in time to do a show Thursday evening, so the week is shot. John Fox, our chief engineer, who is in sunny Australia, and I had a conversation last night. I'm going to go ahead and forego next Friday's program in order to repatch everything here and address some technical issues. You may have heard somewhere along the way that nasty little hum that resides beneath the program, and it's coming from one place and one place only. The only problem is the one place it's coming from is a place that I don't know where it is. So John and I, isn't technology marvelous? John and I are going to re-engineer the studio beginning probably sometime on Friday and work steadily through the weekend until we've got everything squared around in the way that it ought to be so that we can take further steps to do things like video. My darling wife, my beloved Agnes, is also going to be helping on this process as we do a little bit of renovation and renewal inside the studio to change some of the angles around to make things like broadcasting video a little bit easier still. Okay? So that's the schedule. No shows next week. So that's, let's see, this is the fifth. No show, 8.
Some beautiful West Bicod, Virginia. Here's Bob Kincaid on the...
This womb, as Congressman Trent Frank spoke about... This womb, Lynch. This womb...
to Catherine Davis, Minority Outreach Director for Georgia Right to Life. My people are dying, and in Georgia we can point to the abortion industry as one of the leading causes of death of African Americans, 59% of the abortions in 2008 alone. Gee, sweetheart, you think you might want to take a look at the causes of why a mother might seek to terminate a pregnancy when you look at what the right wing has done to try to make life harder and more miserable for folks, not just black, but white, Hispanic, what have you, in the lower classes of society? You think you might want to look at that? No. She's a moron. Therefore, of course, she will not look at it. So there's our first nomination. The phony outrage of the right-wing interview pitch industry. Running to the defense of Representative Trent Franks, who said that Alveda King, by extension, Alveda King, would be better off as somebody's house mammy. He said it. I didn't. I think that's insane. I think it's crazy. I think it's sick. I think Representative Franks is sick, and I think those who support him are sicker still. Sick and twisted. And repugnant and repulsive. You know, when we talk to Jeff Biggers later tonight, you will find out a little bit about a form of slavery I'll bet you didn't even know existed. Because the first mines in Illinois, the land of Lincoln, the first mines in Illinois were dug out of the ground by human beings who had been trapped in human bondage by a legalized form of slavery in that young state. Amazing. Amazing. This is particularly galling because February was Black History Month. February was Black History Month. And with Black History Month coming to a close, Representative Trent Franks boldly and openly called for the return of the bygone days of that master-slave relationship. You know, I just wonder, I don't know particularly what district Trent Franks represents in Arizona. But I wonder if anyone there in the print media, in radio, in anything, had the nerve to call that sick, twisted, monstrous bigot out for his remarks. Silence is, after all, as you know, acceptance, isn't it? Yes, yes, as a matter of fact, it is. So that's our first nominee. We have plenty more. Now let's draw it a little closer to home. Let's tighten the focus down to here in lovely, lovely late winter Appalachistan, most particularly West Virginia. This is from February 26th. I never quite got around to it, but I think you will find it meaningful. This nomination is not for the direct subject of the story, but rather for the background stuff. You all remember Adam Pauly, don't you? Most of you, I'm sure, saw the YouTube video of Adam Pauly at last year's July the 4th picnic up on Kayford Mountain, hosted by Larry Gibson. You saw Adam Pauly. Adam Pauly was the bare-bellied, bare-chested, naked from the waist up, intoxicated rube with the white supremacy tattoos on his neck and so forth. Skinhead, of course. Who screamed obscenities around that picnic and rubbed himself down with hot dogs and hamburgers and mustard while threatening the people peaceably attending Larry's picnic? Yeah. From the Associated Press, February 26th, a bare-bellied man whose foul-mouthed taunting of environmentalist activists was captured on film last summer has been convicted of verbal assault. Taunting of environmentalist activists. Really? I watched the video. I know the folks who go there. I don't think they were gathered as environmentalist activists. I think they were gathered as people celebrating the 4th of July. You know, the anniversary of the announcement of the birth of this nation. But far be it from the Associated Press to not try to skew this one way or another. Well, how would you write that if you were a real journalist? A bare-bellied man whose vulgarity-laden threats of people attending a 4th of July picnic was captured on video last summer has been convicted of verbal assault. That works a little bit better, doesn't it? I think so. Here's the fun part. Raleigh County Magistrate Richard Jones convicted 24-year-old Adam Pauley of Daniels, West Virginia, after a three-hour trial Friday and fined him $100. Pauley also must serve 6 months of unsupervised probation. No, really, unsupervised probation. I'm not kidding. He was acquitted of public intoxication and disorderly conduct. Because, you know, there's nothing disorderly about screaming at a man and his infant child, "I'm going to cut your effing throat." Nothing disorderly about that. Nothing disorderly about being so damn drunk that you rub yourself down with hamburgers and weenies and the lot and stick condiments all. I said condiments. Stick condiments all over yourself. No, hell no. There's nothing disorderly like that. No. Mountaintop removers. That's just a typical tribal dance among the mountaintop removers. It's called the hamburger weenie dance. It involves the ingestion of copious amounts of Bud Light. And then they get it. You know, they're rather like, I guess, the Dionysian cultists of ancient Greece. Nah, I don't think so either. I'm not buying it. No, not even me, and I'm the one. No, not me. Pauley was arrested in September over a July 4th incident on Kayford Mountain where mountaintop removal mining activist Pauley was arrested in September regarding a July 4th incident on Kayford Mountain where Larry Gibson was hosting the Mountain Keepers Music Festival. Why does he have to be described as mountaintop removal mining activist, Larry Gibson? Do you see what I'm getting at in this excess verbiage? It is almost as though someone is trying to create some level of excuse for Adam Pauley's conduct. A YouTube video shows Pauley shouting expletives. Expletives? Really? Why don't we call them what they were? Vulgarities. And goading people into fighting. No, that's not true either. He didn't goad anyone into fighting. No one would fight him. No one there was the fighting kind. It's entirely nonviolent. That's the whole point. At one point, he appears to curse at a child and draw a finger across his throat. Appears to? No. I hate, I despise weak-kneed language. Gives me the fantods. He doesn't appear to curse at a child. He does. And he does draw the slit throat finger across his own throat. But this is Moran Monday, so you're probably sitting there saying, but Bob, where's the nomination? My nomination goes to Raleigh County Magistrate Richard Jones, who, while he had as much as, I do believe, either $500 or $1,000 available to him in terms of the fines he could levy against white supremacist tattooed skinhead monster, decided just to give him a Mr. Pauly, I'm going to fine you $100 and court costs, and I'm going to put you on 6 months unsupervised probation.
You mean I don't got to report to nobody?
That's right. Now you be good now, Mr. Pauly.
Does that mean I got to be good to the tree huggers too?
Well, they are just tree huggers, aren't they? You just try not to stay. Just try to stay out of trouble, Mr. Pauly. And by the way, if you'll speak to my clerk, she'll set you up on a 90-day payment plan for that $100 fine. Yeah, Raleigh County Magistrate Richard Jones, he sure did put the kibosh on violence directed at peaceful protesters, didn't he? Man, that nobody's gonna want to go in front of Magistrate Richard Jones in Raleigh County, because by God, he'll slap them down. I said don't do it. Here's another $100 fine. Another $100 fine, because another Raleigh County Magistrate issued a $100 fine for a human being who punched world-renowned environmental activist Judy Bonds in the head. Yeah, Ruth Tucker got a $100 fine, too, in court costs. Of course, she didn't get the 6 months of unsupervised probation. That's what lets us know that Richard Jones was, by God, serious about Adam Pauly. Disgusted yet? Yeah, true. With any luck, Mr. Pauly will go nuts again, and over the next 6 months, and the good magistrate will be into whacking him for that and the probate violation. But I wouldn't count on it. I wouldn't count on it. Not because I don't expect it. God only knows what Adam Pauly's up to. But I would not expect any member of the judicial system of Raleigh County or any other county in this state or the federal judiciary, I wouldn't count on them getting any of this right. Because this is a line from a movie. Forget about it, Jake. It's Appalachistan. Southern West Virginia is a lawless place. No, that's not true. It's not a lawless place. There's lots of law here. It is simply not used for the benefit of all West Virginians. It's used to the benefit of the coal industry. That's why a child molester walked free on bail, bond, what have you, while a peaceful protester sat in jail on $5,000 cash-only bond. Constitution? Reasonable bail? We don't need a stinking constitution. It may be a busy Moran Monday, because that is by no means the end of where all of this goes. I think you know that, of course. Now we would be wholly remiss if we did not note that Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee is deserving of a Moran Monday nomination. He was fairly a quiver on ABC's This Week with somebody, George Snuffleupagus, having This Week with somebody who isn't George Snuffleupagus on ABC. He was in an absolute froth about the idea of passing some kind of health care reform, which apparently will not include the public option, according to Nancy Pelosi this evening, or earlier today. Lamar Alexander declared that using reconciliation to pass health care through the Senate would be, and these are his words, not mine, the end of the Senate. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's only, and that's why this is a Moran Monday nomination, there's only one thing. Lamar Alexander has voted for reconciliation bills at least four times in his Senate career. I know. So having made a fool of himself on This Week with somebody from ABC News, Lamar Alexander was brought on to Fox News in order to rehabilitate himself. And he said if the Democrats in the House and Senate go via reconciliation and pass some sort of health care that might actually take a bite out of 45,000 needless American deaths every year, well, that he, Lamar Alexander, will lead the charge to make sure that them 45,000 Americans get back to the business they was at, back to the business of dying like God wants them to.
Affordable health care for all Americans.
Nancy Pelosi.
They know that this will take courage. It took courage to pass Social Security. It took courage to pass Medicare. And many of the same forces that were at work decades ago are at work again against this bill.
And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is hoping that one of the forces against this bill, the filibuster, fades away.
And she's got a very tough job this week trying to find the votes to pass health care in the House. Top Line begins right now.
Hello and welcome to ABCNews.com's Top Line. I'm Rick Klein.
And I'm Jonathan Carl.
Every day at noon Eastern Time, we bring you the latest headlines, political reporting and analysis, everything you need to know about politics before you head out the door to lunch, and you keep it going all day long at twitter.com/thenote. We invite you to answer our question of the day. And with that, John, your first Top Line.
Waterloo moment. This story of the week this week is health.
Let's see if we can't run this up.
One of the top political reporters in Texas, Wayne Slater of the Dallas Morning News. But we begin up on Capitol Hill, where political reporters in Texas, Wayne Slater of the Dallas Morning News. But we begin up on Capitol Hill, where Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican of Tennessee, joins us. Senator Alexander, you've been all over the place in the last couple of days. The main point person at the forum on Thursday. I want to ask you, picking up on something you said in this week interview yesterday, Senator. You talked about if this passes, that it would immediately be an effort to repeal it. Is that something that Republicans are coalescing behind? Will there be, if you take control of Congress, either the House or the Senate, will there be a repeal effort that we can expect next year?
Well, that's just my own opinion, but I certainly think so. I mean, the reason the late Pat Moynihan said that we never have passed a major social piece of legislation except by bipartisan vote, like the Civil Rights Bill, is because we not only wanted to pass it, we wanted the country to accept it. So we're going to jam it through in a partisan way, which will take two or three messy months here.
Now, wait a minute. Wait. There's only one problem here. And that's this. The American people want the Senate to get off of its dead, pasty, pudgy, lily-white butt and pass health care. The American people want that. The numbers are abundantly clear. Granted, the likes of the rodeo clown, Glenn Beck, pretends otherwise, but the numbers are there. The American people want this done. Lamar Alexander seems to be taking some sort of Louis XIV, the country's c'est moi approach. And what he means is, he and his right-wing, pasty-faced, doughy-white buddies don't want health care. Because the country really does.
I'm pretty sure that the rest of the year is going to be defined by a movement to repeal it, an election to repeal it, with the health care bill, which is unpopular, defining the race for every single Democratic candidate for Congress.
All right, so, Senator, we were just talking before the show about reconciliation. If the Democrats succeed in jamming this through on reconciliation...
Oh, listen to Jonathan Carl. Jamming this through on reconciliation.
Oh, I think we have a new Moran nominee.
Jamming this through.
Jamming this through. Now, that is a paid professional reporter.
Jamming this through.
Gee, wonder what your agenda is, Jonathan Carl, formerly of CNN or something, now at ABC, doing the noon lunch political program. What's your agenda? Well, my agenda is to get the hell out of the lunch show and onto the evening news.
To using the very same process, reconciliation, to repeal health care reform.
Well, I don't like using the reconciliation for this. I've tried to be consistent in my views. For example, I complained when the Democrats blocked President Bush's nominees, and so I voted to give President Obama's nominees an up or down vote. But let's just take the current moment. The American people have tried to say to the Democratic majority in every way they know how, in elections, in public opinion surveys, in town meetings, we don't want this bill. And if the Democrats pass it, they'll...
Really? They have? Because I keep looking at the numbers, and the numbers don't say that.
He's saying, we don't care what you think. We're going to jam it through. And so that produces the rest of the year in an effort to repeal what they passed.
Senator, I wanted to press that point a little bit. It seems like a critical point. I mean, the Republicans obviously want to be entrusted with control of Congress again, want to take over the Senate. Is reconciliation something that you'd say we would never use for something substantive legislation like health care? Are you prepared to make that kind of statement?
No, I'm not going to prepare to make any kind of statement.
No, because what he knows better than probably these two babbling idiots on the screen talking to him. He knows that the Republicans, should they ever get power back in the Congress, will do what they damned well please and tell the Democrats to sit down and shut up and eat it and smile. The American people be damned. Because the Republicans know what's good for us. The Republicans know what's good for us, proles. What business have we thinking and straining our tiny little minds? The Republicans know what's best. And wingnuts like Limbaugh and Beck have the nerve to talk about a nanny state? Then what is the Republican Party? Brutalizing, domestically violent daddy state? But you know what? You know what's scary about this moron, Lamar Alexander? You know what's scary about him? He's probably going to be successful. And the rest of the Republican tribe, they're probably going to be successful. Because all they have to do is to get Harry Reid to soil himself just a little bit. You know, just one good gamble and lose, and it's over. Amazing, isn't it? That a majority can be cowed into submission by a few painfully, agonizingly ignorant right-wing morons. Are there other morons tonight? I don't know whether to include this in Moran Monday. But Maura alerted me to this earlier. I don't know if you've been following it, but a hazardous materials team has been dispatched to the Internal Revenue Service building in Ogden, Utah. The FBI on the scene investigating white powder found in the building. Local TV news station KSL says that two people have been taken out of the building on stretchers. Yeah, no kidding. Remember how many people thought that Joe Whackstack was a hero
He's just taking out his frustration against the man that's been keeping him down.
The only thing coming out of the FBI is the following statement. The FBI continues to investigate the incident along with its federal and local partners. The area where the threat was received was isolated by removing employees from that area. Some individuals did suffer medical emergencies, which at this time do not appear to be related to this incident. No, they what? Somebody started having chest pains because they thought that that they were under attack, like Austin was last week. Who knows? The killers. Killers walk among us. So at 26 minutes before the hour, we are well into Moran Monday. You know the phone number here, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel. It's 304-658-3333, and we will go directly to the phones. Or not. Hate it when that happens. So, what do you think? Is that enough in the way of Morans? Or dare we note that there are more? Oh, there are more. There are more. But I hesitate. I hesitate to suggest that these people are Morans when some of these activities are so openly hateful. Remember, the word Moran comes from that famous, iconic now photograph of the right winger in St. Louis standing there with his sign, and his St. Louis Cardinals t-shirt on, and his sign says, "Get a brain, Morans, go USA." A Moran is a silly thing, a foolish thing, an uneducated thing, an irrational thing. But coming out of Utah, the same state that may well have been attacked with either a real or phony white powder attack today, well, Utah, of course, being a state, has a legislature. And this is just breathtaking. The legislation that has come out of Utah's legislature. Let's see, some of the greatest hits of the Utah legislature. Proposing to honor gun manufacturers on Martin Luther King Day. More recently, considering eliminating 12th grade as a means of cutting back on education spending. Via Nicole Bell over at Crooks and Liars, this: Utah just became the first state in the U.S. to criminalize miscarriage and punish women for having or seeking an illegal abortion. Utah is proposing a criminal miscarriage law. And that law expands the definition of illegal abortion to include miscarriages. Now, if you talk to a scientific or a medical professional about this, you will find that the human species, for all the fact that there's a few billion of us on the planet, that we're not that successful reproductively. You know, we don't have humans in litters, you know, 8 or 10 of us at a time. And in point of fact, as many as half of all human pregnancies end in what the medical community refers to as spontaneous abortion. I'm pretty sure the number's near half. You can check me out. I might be wrong. But that is the medical term for it, spontaneous abortion. That's the medical term for a miscarriage, a spontaneous abortion. Sometimes the woman in question doesn't even know she was pregnant. Other times, she does. And if it is a baby that is desired and yearned for and ached for, there is nothing more heartrending than a miscarriage. But Utah's criminal miscarriage law, as I noted, expands the definition of illegal abortion to include miscarriages, removes immunity protections for women who have or seek legal abortions. Illegal abortions. Let's do that again. Removes immunity protections for women who have or seek illegal abortions and treats women as presumptive criminals. And that really means something in legalese. That means that women are presumed to have engaged in criminal conduct and leaves them open to criminal prosecution. That whole innocent until proven guilty thing? It doesn't exist. It's not so much in magic underwear land. This statute not only punishes individuals who perform illegal procedures, it punishes women too. And of course, hard cases make bad laws, the old saying goes. And the Utah legislature decided to act as it did because of the case of a 7-month pregnant 17-year-old girl who paid a man $150 to beat her until it caused a miscarriage. Sickening. This passage comes from a website called Vivir Latino. And it says as follows. By the way, that's vivirlatino.com. It says, so, after making it near impossible and mostly illegal for undocumented and even documented women to buy their own health insurance that covers abortions, after making it impossible to get free or reduced cost health insurance that covers abortions, the state of Utah feels it's important to then criminalize women who don't have legal abortions. At Vivir Latino, they ask, but what is a legal abortion? Is getting advice on what herbs to take from a midwife legal? Is taking various medications that many Latinas can get from Mexico and other Latin American countries legal? Is a coat hanger legal? Because there seems to be no definition of what equates legal written into this legislation. That means any woman, anywhere, who, for whatever reason, miscarries, will be subject to criminal charges. Can you imagine? Like I said, in those instances where a baby is hoped for, yearned for, ached for, wanted in every conceivable way, planned for, dreamed of, and a miscarriage happens, the tragedy is not, it runs to depths for that mother and the father that is nigh bottomless. And in the midst of that, the state of Utah, again, I ask you, where is Glenn Beck? Where is Flush Flimball and their, you know, the nanny state? Because, you know, only liberals are capable of having a nanny state. But so what is this? Oh, wait, it's a police state. Again. In the midst and depth of that kind of agony, to have some, and would it be a legal official? Would it be someone from the DA's office? Would it be someone from the local police department, the state police, what, the sheriff's office? Come to a grieving woman's bedside and start asking her about how the miscarriage came to be? What a monstrosity. Of course, don't worry, Utah, because those questions will never be put to a white woman. Those questions will never be put to the fourth wife of some the radical fundamentalist LDS church member living off somewhere among the sagebrush and the yucca out in the desert somewhere. No. Those questions will... Well, first of all, they'll never see her. These questions are going to be put to women of darker skin tone. By the way, Vivir Latino writes, lest you think that prosecutors have ever shown restraint when it comes to pressing criminal charges against women who are making their own, oftentimes very legal, choices about their bodies, please surf around the National Advocates for Pregnant Women website, and that's advocatesforpregnantwomen.org, for just a little while. This organization of lawyers that defend pregnant women from criminal prosecution has worked to defend women who have done such things as being pregnant and addicted to various drugs, to refusing C-sections, to being uppity in the birthing room. So let's say that it's an election year, you're the county prosecutor, you're in a state like Utah, you want to prove that you're pro-life. Why wouldn't you drag some poor, tormented soul around through the hellish labyrinth of legal process in order to prove to the mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking, sky-god, invisible, being-worshipping, faithful, that you're just as faithful as them? I seem to recall reading somewhere that when the Spanish first invaded the Valley of Mexico, that they were surprised, A, at the cleanliness of the civilization. They were surprised at the way that they dealt with their waste, because the Spaniards had come from a place where it was usual for one's boots to be crusted in both animal and human fecal material, bodily waste, food leavings, that sort of thing. They were amazed that that did not happen in Tenochtitlan. It was, I believe, said Hernan Cortes, the most beautiful city I have ever seen in my life. It shone in the sun. They were surprised to note the size of the families. Because being good Roman Catholics, they were under orders to make a baby every time they, you know. And eventually they got around to trying to find out how it was that they managed this, indigenous Americans managed their family size so well. And then the horror set in, and the priests began hopping around like crickets on hot iron. Because, in fact, these peoples had a medical knowledge that far exceeded anything that the Spanish could ever dream of. And the women did know of herbs and remedies to prevent pregnancy or to eliminate an unwanted one. To which, of course, the black-frocked, murder of crows-looking priests screamed heresy, Satanism, demonism, and checked off another box, leading to the judgment that it would be completely all right to utterly rub out the most brilliant civilization that had ever been shown before their eyes. So don't think for a minute that knowledge was not lost. You know, the language that was spoken in central Mexico was one called Nahuatl, N-A-H-A-U-T-L. And everybody thinks that language is gone, but it isn't. There are 1 million people in Mexico today who speak that language. And the lore did not all die, nor did the stories. And so when the folks at Vivir Latino ask, what is a legal abortion? Is it getting advice on what herbs to take from a midwife? Is it taking various medications that Latinas can get from Mexico and other Latin American countries? Is that legal? Not to a Right to Life male, it's not going to be. My inclination is to hope that this law will be overturned as unconstitutional, but remember, that decision ultimately comes to rest in the laps of the crats. Kennedy, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Scalia, who will dutifully, while declaring, we're strict constructionists of the Constitution, yeah, get out that original copy over there, Clarence. Yeah, boss? Well, let's see. We the people. No, nothing. I don't see nothing about abortion in here. So, clearly abortion did not exist at the time of the framers of the Constitution, so we cannot pass upon it. Statute stands. States' rights. Hallelujah. Praise Jesus. Amen. 9/11. I hope you don't think I'm kidding. I hope you don't think I'm just being playful. Because I'm not. This is some sick business. And don't think for an instant that Utah will not use such a statute, not like a scalpel, but like a cudgel. Because they will. Because that is how the right wing behaves. And coming in from Kate on the road to East Tennessee at this point in time, who asks the questions? The elder of the ward will ask and then administer the punishment. Ron in Raleigh says, I take umbrage at your besmirching of the adherents of the Dionysian cult. By your comparison, I will insist on an apology. Oh, yes, I apologize to Dionysians everywhere. That was quite unfair. Oh, by the way, one last little Moran Monday nomination. Everyone who fell for the Salon piece that described Pat Robertson declaring that God hates Chile for getting rid of Pinochet even more than he hated Haiti for doing a deal with the devil. Yeah, we're nominated. I bought it. For at least a paragraph, I bought it. And then there were a couple of clues, and I went, no, wait, stop. But you know what? We're well-intentioned morons, aren't we? I think we are. I mean, listen to the text. This is just mind-blowing. And the reason we're morons is because we expect this of Pat Robertson. This is from the Salon, open Salon section, you know, where anybody can write. The desperate blogger writes, citing what he described as the persecution of a great hero who rid their land of godless communists. As a possible cause, prominent TV evangelist and amateur seismologist Pat Robertson argued that the 8.8 magnitude of the earthquake that struck Chile should serve as a warning to the population that God is even angrier with them than he is with the people of Haiti. Anybody out there, anybody. Does that sound like satire to you, or does that sound like Pat Robertson on the sanest day he has available to him at this point in time? Yeah, let's make it a little worse. If I had to guess, I'd say it must have to do with Chile's personal persecution and attempted prosecution of their great former leader and a personal hero of mine, Augusto Pinochet, who, it should be noted, had never been convicted of a crime when the Lord called him home 3 years ago. The popular host of the 700 Club and longtime bingo circuit icon also added, General Pinochet not only assisted the CIA in the overthrow of Chile's Marxist government, but it is widely credited with personally arranging the meetings of hundreds, perhaps thousands, of his countrymen with Jesus. The only clue in those first two paragraphs that this is satire are the longtime bingo circuit icon and arranging hundreds of meetings of his countrymen with Jesus, and even that one's marginal. So it's forgivable because this is the kind, this sound, this is pitch perfect, this sounds exactly like Pat Robertson, but I nominate myself and anybody else who fell for that as potential Moran Monday honorees. To the phones we go.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Juanita.
I've got something very strange and interesting to report.
Yes.
And I don't know, can I nominate a company?
Certainly. Certainly. There's a corporate category.
Have you ever heard of Raytheon?
Oh, yes, of course.
Oh, you have?
Raytheon? Absolutely. They've got all four trotters and a few of somebody else's in the trough at the Pentagon.
Okay. Well, I just heard a little bit of the local news. In St. Petersburg, there's a certain area there where people have been complaining about water contamination from them. And they're finally coming out and admitting it, and they're saying it's going to take up to 80 years to clean it up. And one man said,
who's going to pay?
Any of us be living by then.
Right, and who's going to pay for it?
I don't know. I didn't get that.
Yeah,
far.
See, that's always the fun part.
I've been looking it up on the Internet, and I found out all kinds of stuff about those folks. But they've been getting away with the... This is some of the things I found out, that, first of all, the chairman and CEO, in case anybody knows anything about that, is William H. Swanson. That's in Massachusetts. And come to find out, we've got them all over down here, especially in Central Florida. Okay. Here's some of the things that they've gotten.
Okay.
They're awarded $229.8 million contract to replace Florida tolling points. I don't know why they needed to be replaced. Raytheon earns top honors in intelligent transportation systems. Now, what does that mean? Intelligent. That has something to do with...
Do it again. Let me hear it again, please.
They earned top honors in intelligent transportation systems. See, I haven't had time to look all these details up.
That's that kind of corporate speak gobbledygook that drives our buddy Eugene Finnerman quite half mad. Intelligent vehicle operation. Is that where the car talks to you and says you're about to back into the fire plug, you know, dimwit?
I'll look all this stuff up. It is so strange. Right here under my nose. Raytheon receives honors for Minnesota electronic toll system development.
Okay, so that's toll gates on some sort of turnpike or something?
I suppose. And then they're selected to provide open road tolling systems in Texas. And guess where else now? Electronic toll system now operational in Israel. They won a $64.5 million contract to develop and install cross-Israel highway electronic toll and traffic management system.
Okay, I'm being told that this might have to do with computer-driven logistics routing. Routing done in seconds that takes humans hours, especially assembling freight trains for efficiency of track utilization.
I don't have it where I can look it up right now, but it sounds right. It's got some, because they are defense. They're in defense also, I found out.
Oh, Raytheon, yes. Raytheon doesn't take a breath without getting a contract from the Pentagon to do it.
And guess what else I found?
What's that?
About them. Remember the mystery Saudi flight? 2 days after the September 11th?
Right, the ones where all the members of the Saudi royal family were hustled out of the United States without so much as a kiss my foot. Yeah, that one.
Okay, I found an article published June the 9th, 2004, in the St. Petersburg Times. Tampa International Airport now verifies flight of Saudis. The government has long denied that 2 days after the 9/11 attacks that the three were allowed to fly. And it shows like they started in Tampa. They went down to Fort Lauderdale.
It was a taxi cab.
They went down to Fort Lauderdale. They went up to Lexington, Kentucky, and back to Tampa. And I guess went on out. But I mean, I knew about that, but I didn't know it had been actually admitted to. And it tells they were accompanied by a former FBI agent and a former Tampa police officer on the flight to Lexington, Kentucky. Then they took another flight out of the country. The two ex-officers returned to Tampa International Airport a few hours later on the same plane. But this is really a deep, deep situation. And you know that if those people, those people over in St. Petersburg that have been complaining for years, so they've been cleared. See, that's another thing. Up until now, they've been told, you know, their water's okay. It's okay to drink, and it's okay, you know, for other things. And of course, it's not.
Right, and we had best be paying attention to water issues, and obviously you are,
yeah.
Juanita.
Yeah.
You know, water issues are a big thing here, but it's all over the world. The next, the next massive wars on this planet are, and I don't mean to get all Alex Jonesy sounding. That's not my point. But the next big wars on this planet are going to be fought for water and not for oil. No, he's really not.
I think so, but I don't listen to him anymore because I don't get my information from him anyway.
But the fact of the matter is, I sent an article off to John and Gail earlier today. You know, in Australia. And it turns out there's a coal operation near that they want to open near Sydney that runs the risk of destroying a major part of the fresh water supply for the entire city.
Well, who was the reporter? He wears the hat and all that. He did a lot of reporting.
Greg Palast.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, the hat gave it away.
It's a book. I didn't ever read the whole book, but I always remembered it stuck in my mind about the Bush connection with water all over the world, especially in this hemisphere, South America and so forth.
Right.
And I always remembered that he reported on that. And
well,
now it's starting to come out in the open.
Sure it is. And, well, I mean, that makes it sound just a little bit flippant on my part. I don't mean it to sound like that. But this stuff can't stay under wraps forever. And the big question is, you know, when you first mentioned this, what's going on there where you are? I said, who's going to pay for it?
That I don't know.
Well, you don't know, but you don't have to know, Juanita. Because even if you say you don't know, you already do.
Well, see, I heard...
You're going to pay, Juanita, you're going to pay for it.
Oh, yeah.
The people are going to pay for it because Raytheon, I mean, the nerve of us.
They're located all over Florida.
Sure.
You know, they're all over the country, but you know there's more than one place their water's getting messed up. You know there is. But anyway, I'm going to find out more about this situation.
Well, I hope you do because don't hide your light under a bushel. Share it with your neighbors. Because the fact of the matter is, Rafe, you know, look, there's a whole bunch of the defense industry all over Florida between tourism and defense industries and things like that. That's what the economy is built on. But
you want me to send you that article about the Saudis?
Oh, I'd love to see that. I'd love to see the Raytheon stuff too.
Okay, so some of them are pretty long, yeah. But anyway, I wanted to say something else too about all the stuff you know that's coming out there. They're saying all these goofy things, and you know it's things that we have thought for years, and now it's coming out in the open. Some of the goofy things, moronic things, you know, that the Republicans especially say. And to me, I saw a bit of a documentary on Charlemagne. And he was trying to get education, his people educated, and himself too. And he was at the time that he was became king, it was thought that only the priesthood should read. That other was a waste
right,
of time.
Right. Yeah. Literacy among the non-priesthood was just demonic.
Yeah. And but he just really pushed it. Well, after his death, that's when things started changing over time, and that's, I think, when the real Dark Ages started. Well, to me, like now, if those people do take over, and they're going to do their level best, like you said about the Alexander and so forth, you know, Lamar Alexander, if they do, and it seems like ever since that, the 21st century started, we're going backwards into it like a dark age. People now, they think,
let me share something with you, Juanita, that I think will bear out what you just said. You know that time after time after time, I have said that there is no real difference between a Christian fundamentalist right winger in the United States and a Muslim fundamentalist member of the Taliban somewhere else, right?
Right. Well, that's right.
You know, they don't like gambling. They don't like booze. They don't,
for themselves.
Right. They don't like their women getting all uppity and acting like human beings. Right? So far, you know, frankly, if Pat Robertson and Mullah Omar sat down to a hot cup of tea, we'd all be in big trouble because they might figure out how much they got in common.
Well, I'm not sure they haven't.
Well, me either. Texas Betsy, I think it was, sent me a story Friday evening. And the headline on it, it's from Agence France-Presse. The headline on it, militants blow up 16 Pakistan schools in February. The dateline is Peshawar, Pakistan. Taliban-linked militants have blown up a school in northwest Pakistan, bringing to 16 the number of such attacks this month, and that was the month of February.
Mm-hmm.
Militants blew up 16 boys and girls' schools in the tribal regions of Momond, Bajaur, Khyber, and Dara Adamkil during the current month, Provincial Education Minister Sardar Hussein Babak told AFP.
He blamed the attacks on Taliban and other extremist groups, including Lashkar-e-Islam, which has some links to Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan. The latest government boys' high school to be attacked was blown up overnight in Momand tribal region. All 21 rooms in the school building were destroyed after bombs planted in seven different places went off. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
16 schools blown up in 1 month.
Yeah.
What is one of the most... what is one of the issues that right-wingers scream about the most? If you've ever heard somebody like Glenn Beck, or not Glenn Beck, Neil Bortz.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, okay, so, see, I know from the response that at some point in time you've heard that idiot.
Oh, what a disgusting sicko.
Yeah, well, you've probably
sicko
heard him.
A compliment.
He does not use the phrase public schools. He uses the phrase government schools.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And the fact of the matter is, as we see, you know, again, going back to the Utah abortion story, miscarriage story, the state of Utah has proposed eliminating, not shortening, but eliminating 12th grade so that, you know, you graduate at the end of your 11th grade year, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. I heard that. Yeah,
yeah, that's retrograde motion. That is going backwards toward a less educated populace, and frankly, we don't have that much of a margin to deal with at this point. And when I read the story about 16 schools blown up in the Pakistan tribal regions in the last month, it just made me sit and think. How many times have I heard Flush Flimball go on and on about the failure of education in this country?
Uh-huh.
How many times, I forget which wingnut it was, but he's a darling of the right, who said if he ever got to be president, the first thing he'd do would be eliminate the United States Department of Education.
I don't know which one. Choose from.
I think it may even be a routine platform of the Repiglican National Committee.
Yeah.
Here in West Virginia, and it was all over the country too, there was a drive on for years that we seem still to be caught in toward consolidating lots of little community schools into one great big Franken school. And test scores go down, dropout rates go up, teen pregnancy goes up. It's a total nightmare. But you get a little closer, and then look at No Child's Behind Left.
Yeah.
That thing is designed to declare schools to be failures, and it is predicated on the presumption that public education is a bad thing.
Yeah. Well, they're shutting down some of them too. If they're, you know, don't.
Right. So look here. Why would, you know, if you're a militant in Pakistan, why would you blow up schools?
Well, why not? I mean, education is a freeing thing usually.
Yeah, exactly.
Done the right way.
Exactly. Exactly.
And, but
exactly.
It's not done over here at all anymore. I mean, it's been going down.
If you're teaching boys and girls in the tribal regions of Pakistan to read and write, and to think for themselves, then your ability to be an authoritarian autocrat,
right,
is in severe jeopardy with the next generation coming up.
Right.
Well, we had a relatively well-educated population in this country at one point in time.
Right, right.
And everything the Repiglican Party has done has been geared at turning that clock back, at stopping that trend toward education, at making it harder to go to college, at making it harder for primary and secondary education institutions to convey the information that they need. You know, my children are in the public school system now, and they spend a year having teachers who don't want to be doing it teaching them what's on the upcoming test.
Right, right.
There's no critical thinking. There's no processing. It's, you know, the answer to this is C.
Yeah. It's just like in the Bible, I guess it was Babylon, you know, where when they conquered the children of Israel, they moved them from where they were familiar, you know, and they
right.
they
took. That's how you eliminate a culture.
A confused state, and that can happen very easily, Bob. And even in a family, it can only takes a couple of generations to completely do a turnaround, you know, on any kind of base. And the thing is that if we don't believe in science, you know, then we're going to go backwards. People are not going to be able to read. I think a lot of them are encouraged to get out of school. It's been terrible down here for a number of years. And one principal even got a reward for trying to get the middle school kids to want to learn. You know, they were made fun of by one another for being, you know, if they wanted to learn something, that was supposed to be a sign of you're not cool or whatever. And this has been going on for a long time. It's just like all this stuff mess with the medical. It's been going on for a long time. And you know what they did to the doctors, don't you?
What?
They slipped up and they didn't raise their payment rates. So there's going to be more and more doctors who are not going to be covering Medicare. And you know how the Republicans will use that. But, I don't know, some way it slipped. It was the Senate. I heard a guy that, from Florida, a doctor from Florida this morning on Washington Journal. And he said that that's what he was talking about. And, people's ideas, you know, like that when they talk about tort reform, and he said the tort reform they're talking about, the Republicans are talking about, is not what I'm talking about. He said he believed that anybody that had been seriously injured deserved any amount of money they could get. But he was talking about some of the things, and he said another thing that will happen is if they say, well, you can get up to $250,000 or whatever, a lot of people are going to be filing and plugging the courts up on the gamble that they can get some of that money. You see what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
If they don't care about whether it's how many millions. They could get some of that $250,000, it'd be worth their gamble. And you know, people know how to work a system. They just do. There's always somebody that knows how to work a system. And you're just not going to get rid of all corruption. It's just life. This life is not perfect. It's got corruption galore in it. And you just have to use, you know, choose between the two evils, the lesser of two evils. Anyway.
I know. I say it from time to time, something evil this way comes, Juanita.
Yeah, right. But have you noticed this thing? We just thought, oh, boy, the 21st century. But I'm telling you, ever since it started, we're just going backwards and backwards. And now these people, these evil, wicked people are coming out and saying, just like that guy said, it'd be better off to be slaves. Well, let him be a slave.
You know, I know you know your Bible.
Well, I know more than some people.
Well, I think you've probably forgotten more than most people know. That's a compliment.
Thank you, but
you remember how the children of Israel are in the desert, and they'd look at Moses every time things got a little tough, and they'd say, "You know what? We were better off under Pharaoh."
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
We had three hots and a cot. Life was good.
We had cucumbers, onions.
And how much of that is this?
I know it.
And, you know, I don't know if you ever go over to BartCop.com, but his...
I have it in time, you know.
Well,
yeah.
you need to just sort of thumb back through the last several pages. Start with this. Start with the current one and thumb backwards. There's an ad on almost every page lately that's, he calls it Disturbing Ads from the Past.
Uh-huh.
And underneath it, it always has the caption, "This is the America the teabaggers want to go back to." Just see some of those things, Juanita. I mean, I don't know where BartCop's finding them, but they are amazing. Just absolutely amazing.
But, you know, it's so sad. You know, people just follow everything that is against them, and these people are laughing at them.
Sure they are.
They're laughing at them. They know they're leading them on. They're leading them astray.
Oh, you mean the people who are doing the evil stuff? Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
The teabaggers, you know, the teabaggers were created as nothing more and nothing less than cannon fodder in the culture war.
And you know what, too? Now the Republicans are coming out, you know, saying, well, the people don't want it. You know, we've been to all these, what you call them, townhouse meetings and all. But those are not everybody. There's a lot of people that aren't able to go to all of those things, go all over the country to all of those things. You know, there's people that are not able to walk and people can't see. But, you know, among a few other people who are in helpless situations that can't help themselves at all. And they're not being as what they want. But, no, they're using these people like, who's the guy that, I call him the fuddy-duddy Republican, Grassley.
Yeah.
I went to all of, you know, he got up at, you know, when he was at that conference.
I know, he's very nasal, isn't he?
Yeah. I went to all these people, and these people, they, you know, and I learned, and this is what he said. He said more than once, I learned more than about medical insurance than I've ever known before. I thought, well, you idiot, you've been in all the office all this time, and you don't know that much about the medical services people have. Make it your, you know, obligatory reading, you know, or whatever. Oh, God, Bob, I tell you, it's scary sometimes, ain't it?
It is more than that, Juanita. More than that.
Yeah, and I think especially for you who have grandchildren and young children.
Yeah, we're getting
close for our children.
And frankly, it was predicted some decade or so back that mine would be the first generation that started going backwards. In other words, every generation up till now has sought to make things better for the next generation than it was for them.
Right, and
it's
started that way. And no matter what your level, your people's level of poverty that they came from, it did get better. Maybe you're still in poverty, but it's still better than what they had. But it's not anymore.
Exactly. That's like Ron and Raleigh writing in, Juanita, and saying, "My brother's a personal injury lawyer in Denver. The problem with the $250,000 cap is that an individual with a private firm going against a corporate law firm can't sustain a case when the corporate firm can just draw out the case until it's not worth it to pursue it any further." That's part of it. Sure. But if, well, there's economic damages and non-economic damages.
Yeah.
And, for instance, saying that, you know, that non-economic damages should be capped at $250,000, you know what that says? That says that because non-economic damages are expressed by things like loss of consortium.
Yeah.
Okay, and I know that sounds like a real gobbledygook phrase, but that's saying that, for instance, something that a doctor did to a man's wife or a woman's husband or a woman's wife or a man's husband, that something that was done there diminished the state of their marriage and made them unable. And it's not always sex.
Yeah, right.
It's stresses and it's caregiving and all of that.
Yeah.
And to put a cap on that, you know, because remember, Juanita, the tort reform crowd is the same crowd that's all in favor of traditional merge. Right?
Yeah.
And yet these same people who are in favor of traditional merge are in favor of tort reform, which puts a dollar figure limit on the value that that traditional merge can have.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I hesitate to use a personal example or anyone as a personal example, but if a person is in a happy marriage and the other member of that marriage is deprived of the ability to enjoy that marriage, and again, I don't mean just sexually, I mean you know, getting up and going to church together.
And sometimes when you're injured, your character or mood changes.
Right. How dare? Right, but how dare these right-wing SOBs, how dare they put a dollar value on that?
Yeah.
Because these are the same people who are saying, well, you know, that's the kind of thing you can't measure with money, especially if you're expecting one of our corporations to give it to you. Yeah, I loathe them. Juanita, I have to run along, but it's been a wonderful conversation this evening. Okay. And let me know about Raytheon.
I got one article to send to you right now about the side of the Saudis.
All right, good deal. You take care, Juanita.
Okay, you too.
Bye now.
Night.
From Central Florida, that is our dear friend, Juanita. And rolling onward, hey, welcome to the program.
Hello? Oh, this is Edward in Dallas.
Oh, hey, Edward, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I really enjoyed you talking to Juanita.
Juanita is a pearl of great price, Edward.
But you know something? She brought something up that I've been thinking about, but I haven't mentioned it to anybody. For the first time in my life, I'm afraid in my own country. I am afraid.
And not of some terrorist.
No. No, absolutely not. And also, you brought out something, too, that I've been thinking about. Fundamentalism is fundamentalism. It doesn't make any difference whether you're a fundamentalist Baptist or a Roman Catholic or Muslim or a Hindu or whatever.
No, because they all share a common rejection of the human ability and the human nature to go forward. All fundamentalisms are based in a desire to stand rooted in the present or hopefully to move backwards into the past.
I think it's moving backwards.
Me too.
Well, see, I was a church organist for about 15 years. And I played in, oh my gosh, let's see, Methodist, Baptist, Episcopal, Lutheran, Christian Science churches. And the Episcopal Church and the Christian Science Church were my favorite. And I felt so historical in the Episcopal Church because it was built in 1774. And when I played there a long time ago, the organ was 120 years old. Boy, did I feel historical.
Oh, and those things take a while to break in, too, don't they, Edward?
Yeah, they do. Anyway, also, the Christian Scientists were, they were so businesslike. They never asked me to play for anything that I wasn't paid for. And you know what the damn Baptists did? They actually called me into their board meeting and asked me if I wouldn't consider playing for them, for the glory of God, and not get paid. And God never paid for one of my music lessons. And I walked out, and I've never been in that church since.
Good on you. Well, can't you play for the... And, you know, you get to look at the preacher at that point and say, you preaching for the glory of God, brother?
I have some other funny stories about that church, but I can't tell you. Anyway, I did know of a funny thing that comes to mind. You know, our friend Dick Armey?
Yes.
Well, Dick Armey first came on the scene here in Texas. He was a professor of economics at a university here. And this fellow who had this talk show, somebody brought up the name of Dick Armey. This was years ago. And this guy said, Dick Armey? Dick Armey. That sounds like the chorus line in a gay nightclub.
Well, you know what they say now, Edward, if you're gonna have a teabag in movement, you want a Dick Armey to lead it.
Yes. You're telling me.
And he does. Edward, I have to roll along because we've got a conversation with Jeff Biggers coming up, but I love hearing from you.
Okay, take care.
All right. Bye now. Bye. Calling from Dallas, that's our good buddy Edward. Brother, can't you play it for the glory of God? Preacher, do you cash the glory of God once every couple of weeks? Yeah, I thought so. All right, so coming up, a conversation with Jeff Biggers, award-winning author of Reckoning at Eagle Creek, The Secret Legacy of Coal in the Heartland. You want to be around for this. Any conversation with Jeff is always, always a joy and a treat and informative. And we will get right at it here in just a matter of minutes. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to The Horn.
Those who made by hand.
24 minutes before the hour. We are halfway through this Monday night edition of The Horn. And as promised earlier, I have on the phone with me Jeff Biggers. Jeff is the author of Reckoning at Eagle Creek, The Secret Legacy of Coal in the Heartland. He is also the author of In the Sierra Madre and the required reading for anyone who wants to understand where the horn comes from, the American Book Award winning The United States of Appalachia. Let's waste no time. Let's get Jeff on here right away. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. Great to be back on.
Oh, it is always a joy, and always a thrill to talk. You know, not just coal, but culture, because ultimately what we're talking about here, and I think what you really, really get to the heart of with Reckoning at Eagle Creek, is the impact that coal has had on family histories, on cultural histories, on the very nature of how what we call the modern United States came to be the modern United States. What led you on this journey?
Well, you know, I think you make a really good point, because I often say I didn't write just a book about the dark legacy of coal, but I wrote a book about the bright legacy of people in the coal fields and their incredible resiliency and resistance to stand up to big coal for the past two centuries. So what led me to write the book really was my own personal reckoning, and it was by no choice of my own. I was working as a journalist abroad down in Mexico in a very interesting situation in Sierra Madre, where there was a native group who were really under assault by logging companies and drug lords. And while I was there chronicling what was happening to them, I get a letter from my uncle in Kentucky saying, hey, the same thing has happened here. You know, while you're abroad, coal companies from the outside, in this instance it was local coal companies who eventually leased out to one of the worst mountaintop removal offenders from eastern Kentucky, they came in and strip mined our ancestral property, our homeland, where our last cousin was the last holdout in our holler of Eagle Creek. And so literally in the instance, 200 years of our history was completely eliminated and strip mined and destroyed.
And geographically speaking, reading this book, I developed a new appreciation for Southern Illinois, because tend to think of Illinois as this flat place with corn on it that winds up in Chicago, but that's not true. There's actually mountain hill country in Southern Illinois.
Exactly. You know, I think we think of Chicago and Al Capone, and we think of corn, and we forget the final C, of course, is the coal fields, and that's the third part of the bottom state. It's also referred to as Egypt, because you have the Mississippi meeting the Ohio in this sort of delta region. You know, my family is from the southeastern corner of southern Illinois, just 15 minutes from Kentucky. And in fact, we're 330 miles away from Chicago, and just two whoops and a holler, of course, from Memphis and then down in the Alabama hills. And so definitely the culture was definitely more akin to the Ozarks in Appalachia than it was in the rest of the state. Geographically, too, just the region is gorgeous. It's the Wisconsin glaciers didn't quite reach this part, and so it left this gorgeous range of the Shawnee Hills, also known as the Illinois Ozarks, where you had a diversity, of course, that rivals anything even as far as the Smoky Mountains in terms of flora and fauna, 1,100 species of flora and fauna. And it was just really, it's one of the last undiscovered places in America, I think, Bob, because you have this an incredible culture, almost like an island within the heartland itself.
And it developed with that cross-continental drift of many of the same folks who settled the Appalachians, who settled the South, looping down through the rivers, down the Tennessee, onto the Ohio, into the Mississippi, and, you know, there you are. Your book begins with an examination of Native peoples. This has been the discovery of coal almost contemporaneous with the arrival of white folks there. This is a long history of what predation based upon coal allowed. There's a quote from Jefferson in the book that I just it was harrowing to me. Everything that we're told about the founding fathers and the lofty ambitions and ideals of freedom and everything, it seemed to hit a brick wall when it came to Native peoples.
You know, it definitely debunked a lot of our American heroes. The deeper I went into really looking at the origins of the coal industry and how did this all happen, the worse it got. And so many of our American heroes, from Abe Lincoln to John L. Lewis all the way back to Thomas Jefferson, you began to see were so manipulated by commerce and profit that they were willing to do anything in order to pursue the coal industry. Thomas Jefferson, it's an amazing story, Bob, because he runs off to England and he sees the industrial coal fire revolution. He sees that, you know, it's just a little peck of coal could do more work than all these horses. And so Jefferson, being the visionary he was, came back and wanted to launch and really ramp up the coal industry in the United States. At that point, we were still importing it from Britain. And, of course, the problem was all these stones as fire, as good biblical people referred to them, were sitting under the feet of the natives. And so one by one, we began to find out where the natural resources were. In the Ohio River Valley, of course, were some of the richest outcroppings. And in particular, southern Illinois, right in Eagle Creek, was very famous because we had these incredible salt wells. The richest salt wells, which were really the window to the west, were right in our little holler.
And this all predates the discovery of this sort of thing in Appalachia, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we actually discovered coal in Illinois, not in Appalachia. It's the French who actually came in the 1600s and found this black rock among the Shawnee and off the Illinois River. And the French, in fact, took back 4 Shawnee and a crate load of coal, and that changed the whole face of America because they came back within a very few years with 500 African slaves and began the coal industry. The problem is this same concept not only continued with the British reign over the Midwest, but it continued with the Americans. And so Jefferson, you know, who's really one of our great heroes, I admire Jefferson, really at the end wanted those coal reserves. And he wrote that horrific letter, of course, to Governor Harrison there in Indiana and said, no matter what you do, get them in debt, get them drunk, but get that land because we want those resources. And Bob, what blew my mind too was to realize that, you know, Lewis and Clark going out west, were not simply trying to discover what was there, but they were making inventories of every mineral deposit along the way. And even before they left, you know, they had this incredible record that, wow, in southern Illinois, you have these incredible coal deposits. And that's really what was driving our westward expansion. What are these mineral rights?
And so once you get rid of the Indians, and of course, I was amazed to find out that Andrew Jackson is tied in with all of this. One of those names, and this is the magic of the book for me, I saw one of those names of Andrew Jackson's business partner, a fellow by the name of General John Coffey. And lo and behold, he comes straight out of where I come from. The hospital in my hometown and the high school in my hometown were named after one of his family members and after him. So the process of running off the Indians is the Creeks and so forth. It's prosecuted down in South Alabama, North Alabama's coal company, or coal country, and it works its way up into southern Illinois. And then comes slavery in Illinois. That blew my mind.
You know, it's once again, it's this dark legacy that what I found was this driving force of profit and commerce by outside companies to get that darn black rock at any price. But, of course, as we know, Bob, then it becomes this horrific cautionary tale for today, because so much of what I see happening today is based on decisions made 200 years ago. I mean, what we found, of course, so here comes our ancestors. My ancestors coming in from the hills of North Carolina and the hills of northern Alabama, and we, of course, drifted into to southern Illinois as some of the first pioneers. We literally were the first Baptist missionaries to come into the area and the first salt workers. And what we eventually found out was the villainization, the criminalization of the natives in order to remove them came around and hit us as well. That already by the 1840s and the 1850s, there was a discussion by suddenly new immigrants coming in from the industrial areas of England saying, we need to get rid of these backwoods hillbillies because they're basically sitting on rich areas. And there already was a discussion of removal a century ago. And that was more or less launched by a removal of Native Americans, but that still today, of course, we see with mountaintop removal that the largest forced removal of American citizens is still taking place in the coal fields.
And, of course, you mentioned mountaintop removal. Also noteworthy within the book, another one of those evil births that took place in southern Illinois, strip mining itself, correct?
Exactly. Once again, Illinois has all these horrible firsts. And of course, you know, Harry Cottle in his great classic called Night Comes to the Cumberland, one of the first great books to analyze the impact of coal mining on our cultures, he wrote that the rape of Appalachia got its practice in Illinois. And I think a lot of people didn't realize he was referring to the fact that strip mining started, commercial strip mining, in southeastern Illinois in the 1850s, Bob. They brought in their horses and scrapers and the plows because the outcroppings were so high and began to tear away our hills. And then they brought in those steam power engines. You know, the same thing that dug out the Panama Canal? They brought those same kind of steam power shovels and started digging out and leaving pits in our land.
The Mammoth Bucyrus, right.
Exactly. And then, of course, we graduated to the walking drag lines, you know, these 21 stories tall, the tallest building in the county, you know, and they began to scoop up two seams of coal at the same time and leave behind meteor craters. And now, of course, they simply use ammonium nitrate fuel explosives to blow up the mountains in Appalachia or blow up the hills. They were using ANFO and Eagle Creek as well, and didn't use bulldozers and heavy equipment operators to finish the task.
There is, at the promotional video for the book, there is a photograph of a postcard that features a steam shovel as an enticement to come to southern Illinois. That was mind-blowing, Jeff. What does this area look like now?
Well, it's this is sort of what Appalachia is going to look like in 50 years, because here's this pockmarked region that never was really considered, you know, so much of our strip mining happened before SMACRA, the Surface Mining Reclamation Control Act. And so you have just miles and miles of wasteland that now gives a very haunting atmosphere, you know, because it's sort of unmanaged grasslands and brush and whatnot. And, of course, they've made attempts at reclamation in the last 30 years, but it's pitiful, as you know. You know, less than 2% of our land in southern Illinois, just like Appalachia, has ever been returned to any kind of productive economic activity after it's been strip mined. But even worse, because of the unique diversity of our forests where we are, they've never been able to replant and recreate the forest, of course, that they've destroyed. That just in, like in Appalachia with mountaintop removal, the damage is irreversible. Now, Eagle Creek itself, which is this gorgeous, gorgeous forest, it's tucked in along what's called the Garden of the Gods, you know, and then up by Eagle Mountain, which were the first federally designated wilderness areas in the Midwest. At the same time that North Carolina had the Pisgah National Wilderness Act, we had our own Wilderness Act in Illinois. But if you look at the map, how the demarcation of the wilderness area was laid out, they left out this incredible panhandle of Eagle Creek, where I'm from, just because we had coal. You know, and literally there's a loophole in the act that says if you have resource attributes, which of course were interpreted as coal, they still even had an 8-year loophole to strip mine. And so there's no reason our land wasn't protected under the Federal Wilderness Act, other than the fact that you had this incredible coal lobby that wanted that coal and was going to get at it no matter what.
It's astonishing. You know, water issues, Jeff, are huge around here where I am. What's it done to the water? I mean, the name of a stream is in the title of your book. What has it done to the waters around Eagle Creek?
The Eagle Creek itself is completely sterile now. We used to go fish as children, and it was famous, of course, for the springs. The earliest mining survey report was done by Robert Owen, the great Scottish visionary. His son was the first great geologist in Indiana and Illinois, and he came in the 1850s. It's a very funny scene. And he was with this real character named George Sellers, who went on to be sort of a character in a Mark Twain novel. And they couldn't believe three things. One is the outcroppings were the biggest they'd ever seen in their life. It was going to be the biggest coal hit west of the Appalachian Mountains. The second thing, though, was they couldn't believe the amount of springs, and both sulfur springs, the mineral waters, that this was sort of a Garden of Eden in terms of clean water. And the third thing they couldn't imagine was the incredible prehistoric civilization that had been in this area, because we were so close to the salt wells. And those salt wells fed all the great prehistoric mountain cultures, including the Cahokia Empire. And so they realized that this was an incredibly unique place on Earth, you know. And now today, Bob, because of the discharges that were allowed legally into the stream, not only is the Saline River completely polluted, and Saline, of course, gives Saline County its name, but Eagle Creek is completely sterile and destroyed, that hundreds of miles of our streams have been ruined because of discharges from the abandoned mines. We have so many underground mines in the area as well. And the streams have all dried up. You know, and part of the joke, of course, is that Eagle Creek had the same sort of backwoods, moonshining, gun-toting hillbilly culture that you have in Appalachia. And I'll never forget my grandfather explaining to me that moonshine was an indicator of the environmental health of the region. You know, and listen to me for just a second on this one. Moonshine needs two things. It needs clean water, clean spring water, and it needs hardwoods to fire up the still. And when we lost that last moonshiner in Eagle Creek was famous for its moonshine, it's because they had killed the waters and they completely deforested the region of our hardwoods.
Amazing. Amazing. And, well, it certainly kind of puts a respectable face on moonshine, doesn't it?
I think what it tells us is we have purposely sort of criminalized and marginalized rural cultures, woodland cultures, that ultimately were sustainable, that ultimately had a connection to the land. You know, that people chose to live up in the hills of southern Illinois for a reason, because historically down in the lowlands and the swampy areas down by the river, there was a tremendous amount of disease, and that they're able to bring the woodland culture of Appalachia into the woodland culture of southern Illinois. And it's not to romanticize the woodland culture. I mean, eventually everybody had to find jobs beyond farming and beyond hunting. But the idea was that there was a connection, that we did live off the land. There was a use of the medicinal herbs. There was a use of the food from the woodlands. The pork, I mean, the pigs were put out in to feed on mast, you know. And there was just an incredible connection of a woodland culture that ultimately was villainized and marginalized in order to push the people off the land.
Well, Jeff, as you've noted, the area was dotted with little coal towns, similar to what I've seen here in Appalachia. And you've mentioned the lack of economic diversification. Where do those towns stand now?
You know, I think probably one of the best indicators of the devastation of coal, the devastation of clean coal, as they want to refer to it today. And of course, as we know from our research, is that the slogan of clean coal has been used since the 1890s, when Mr. Peabody, Francis Peabody, the great Chicago coal peddler, took out ads in his newspaper for smoke-free clean coal. And within a couple of years, he was digging mines down in our neck of the woods. But what happened ultimately to this area was that it had kept out any kind of diversification or sustainable economy, and that virtually by 1905, all the mineral rights of the region had been bought up by Chicago and outside interests. So the colonies, the region itself served as some sort of vassal colony for the whims of outside markets. You know, that southern Illinois, much like many counties in West Virginia, are completely owned by outsiders, and therefore they put a complete stranglehold on any kind of diversification. You know, so this mythology, of course, that coal has brought us a few jobs is so wrong, because we're living in an area that has had the highest unemployment, the highest poverty rates, and the worst health care factors than anywhere else in the country. In the 1930s, we had the highest infant mortality in the nation, probably worse than most third world countries. You know, there was an incredible report written during one of the worst busts that Southern Illinois is in a state of complete and utter hopelessness. And that sense of hopelessness has resonated for years, you know. You know, Bob, our coal industry peaked in 1918. That's a century ago. And so for the next century, they've kept us on this chain of coal while they continue to plunder and take out billions of dollars while leaving people in ruins and no options, no alternatives but to leave the region. You know, and it's certainly a cautionary tale that you can relate to in West Virginia.
Without a doubt. And I find it very interesting, particularly, Jeff, because when we pay for our electric power here, we make a point of purchasing wind credits. And our wind credits come, oddly enough, from Illinois. And yet I'll warrant from what you're saying that that wind farm is not down in Little Egypt, is it?
Oh, no. Those wind farms are way up in the north, and rightly so, too, because, once again, it's the factor of wind potential, and that definitely comes up on the plains, not down in the southern areas. But what we want, I think, now is this concept of a just transition. You know, we get 45% of our electricity from coal, and we know it's not going to end tomorrow, but we want to determine that we need to agree that we're going to commit somehow to a coal-free future. In order to get there, though, we need what we call a just transition, that something like a GI Bill for coal miners, something that would provide massive reinvestment in clean energy jobs. You know, we don't need to set up windmills. We can build windmills in our towns. We can build solar panels. You know, we have a whole part of the culture that can be employed to do massive reforestation programs in what could potentially be another great carbon sink for America. We have people who should be trained as electricians and plumbers to work in these incredible weatherization and green jobs that the rest of the nation are getting. I mean, I think there's a little bit of bewilderment right now in Illinois is that why is the rest of the country plugging in and being part of this great clean energy boom? And those of us in the coal fields are being left behind. You know, all we're getting is people like liberal Democrats like Dick Durbin, our great senator from Illinois, and even our president, who basically talk about the clean energy revolution, but then come back to us and say, and for you, another generation of coal. And it's almost like a death sentence, Bob.
Well, it is, Jeff. And where does President Obama, I don't want to say where does he get off, but where did this prattle? Because one of the first things I noted in the book early on, the Saudi Arabia of coal, he didn't just say it there. Senator Rockefeller was taking him stumping around West Virginia, he was trotting out that, well, West Virginia is going to be the Saudi Arabia of coal. What's he thinking?
Well, you know, I greatly admire our president, just like I admired Senator Dick Durbin. But I feel like ultimately, Bob, they've been hoodwinked, and they haven't taken the time to really understand the external costs of the coal industry. You know, President Obama, for the first time, came down to Southern Illinois in 1997 on a golf junket. And there he was in Benton, Illinois, the town of John Malkovich, you know, and Malkovich, of course, comes from coal miners. And he was sold this bill of goods about how we're going to revamp the coal industry. Of course, the coal industry in Illinois collapsed after the Clean Air Act because we have incredibly high sulfur coal. We can't compete with you in Appalachia. We can't compete with Wyoming. But they told him, you know, Barack Obama, you've got 38 billion tons of coal under our feet. And, of course, virtually all of it is unreachable. It's incredibly deep and dirty and completely infeasible to get economically now. But he bought into this idea that this was a way to help the region. And, of course, I feel like he never really understood the darker legacy of it, the darker history, the fact that it kept us beholden to outside interests. And this book really was written as a plea to our president to say, hey, you basically cut your teeth on the coal industry in my region, and you didn't listen to our side. And so my prologue is called Mr. President, Welcome to the Saudi Arabia of Coal. To say, hey, I want you to see face, just right up in your face the reality of the front lines. That if you're going to continue with this kind of clean coal rhetoric, which of course has been trotted out every decade whenever there's some sort of problem in the coal industry, then you have to openly accept that there's going to be collateral damage. And we are the collateral damage. We have lived as a national sacrifice zone for two centuries. And so my attitude is, if we're going to truly deal with the coal industry, it's almost a war of words now, this war of clean coal and the Saudi Arabia of coal and whatnot, then we really need to put the dark legacy onto the table and make them confront it, make them realize that not only has it been incredibly costly, it's been incredibly deadly for the nation.
Well, I can't help but think that we're winning. Jeff, I don't know if you saw the story today or not, but even Progress Energy, who gave $1 million to the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity last year, today decided that they'd had enough of them and bowed out. So I think that, you know, that just transition away from coal is not some sort of pipe dream. It's not some sort of hoped for thing. It's something that people are working toward on a daily basis. You mentioned some activists down there in the Eagle Creek region. What kind of work is going on toward that just transition?
Well, like I said, I think first and foremost is the idea that we have to commit to a coal-free future, and that's a project, of course, you know, that I've launched myself. It's called the Coal-Free Future Project. that until we say, be it 2020 or 2030 or even 2040, we're going to live without coal, my attitude is we're going to continue to be blindsided by this kind of clean coal chatter. You know, the cruelest irony, of course, Bob, is that the first experimental plant for carbon capture and storage called Futuregen is actually taking place in eastern Illinois, only about an hour from where we had the birthplace of strip mining. And so once again, we're being subjected to and yet another initiative, another novelty in the coal industry. And as we all know, carbon capture and storage is one of the great shams. It's one of the great new bridges to nowhere, because not one scientist can come onto your program and tell you that we can have the technology to operate on a commercial level in an economical, feasible way within the next 10 to 20 years. It's truly something that's going to be too little and too late. And yet we're pouring billions upon billions of dollars into this black hole.
Well, didn't I see President Obama in the last week or so announcing that he wants to build 10 of those things?
Yeah, and once again, it's totally a total misconstruction of reality right now, because the only thing we know for sure, I mean, we don't even know about accidents and leaks, Bob. You know, and here we had an earthquake in Chicago just 10 days ago. But what we do know, and what the coal industry knows, is that any attempt to capture carbon emissions, you have to capture that stuff, you have to compress it, and then you have to pump it back into the ground. And that means you need 30% more energy. And so what does that mean? It means that any kind of conservation efforts that are made in the technology will be canceled out, and we actually will have to increase coal production. So carbon capture and storage, even if it's the most successful thing tomorrow, even if we could launch it tomorrow, means we will be mining at least 30% more coal. And that is what the coal industry wants. And that, to me, ultimately is what is not acceptable, because that means more mountaintop removal, more strip mining, more longwall mining, which is destroying central Illinois, and more destruction in our coal-filled communities.
And of course, more of the detritus, I think, of places like Perry County, Alabama, getting Kingston, Tennessee's coal ash dumped on it. This thing begins to what you're describing is the front end of a feedback loop, Jeff, and the question for people listening, I suppose, is what can they do?
I think people first and foremost have to work to stop mountaintop removal, because, for example, even though mountaintop removal is something that takes place in the area of Appalachia, you know, we have coal mining in 26 states. And I often really want to point out that I appreciate the fact that you have a national view of this. It's not that, that mountaintop removal is only an Appalachian issue, but it's a national issue. It's indicative of our whole national coal mining policy. And I think the first thing we have to do is stop the completely egregious human rights violations of mountaintop removal, because, as you know, we don't need it. It's less than 7 to 8% of our national coal production. You know, for the first time in 25 years, Bob, we had stockpiles of coal during the summer. You know, we simply don't need coal. And you're all right. We're on a roll right now. When I started the research for my book, we used about 53% of our energy, 53% of our electricity came from coal fire plants. When my book came out, we were down to 45%. You know, and I think Wall Street and the rest of the investors realized that clean energy is going to be the future. But the first thing we have to do foremost for me is stop mountaintop removal, because it's the worst violation of our laws and the worst violation of human rights. And from there, we have to stop strip mining. And from there, we have to move to eventually shut down and transition our underground mines. And from there, we have to begin this incredible just transition to make the coal fields ground zero for any kind of clean energy revolution. That sort of what boggles my mind is when you have people like Al Gore and the Repower America movement, who did this tremendous effort to bring green jobs and clean energy to our company, our country. If you look at their map, they completely waltz around the coal fields. You know, they talk about green jobs and clean energy in the Midwest and in the Deep South and in the Southwest and in California, and they never talk about bringing clean energy and green jobs to Appalachia or to southern Illinois or out to the coal fields of the western states. And so I think that's one of the first things we do, especially liberal listeners of your program, is we need to talk to our allies that they can't be afraid to go into the coal fields and talk about clean energy jobs. But that really is where we need to be making this discussion and this debate.
Well, I agree wholeheartedly with you. And somewhere along the way, I've been beating on the same drum that you have about this idea of transitioning people currently working in things like mountaintop removal, finding a way for them to transition away from it and still have a meaningful lifestyle, still have human dignity, still be able to pay their bills. I think that really is a huge front in this ongoing struggle. Jeff, I know that you are staying very, very busy going out and about and promoting the book. Are you going to be, do you have any more, are you touring anytime soon where folks could maybe come and see you work in person?
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm constantly speaking on the road. Just spent several days in New York City. We did a program in Harlem talking about the core roots of Black History Month, how that, of course, came out of West Virginia with Carter Woodson. We had a program at Yale University taking our Coal Free Future project. We've taken that all around the Midwest and the East Coast, and we'll be actually out in San Francisco on March 13th and 14th with the Coal Free Future Project. We created a play based on my book that brings in a mountaintop removal theme that's called Welcome to the Saudi Arabia of Coal. And I think it's quite a unique play. What our attitude is, we've brought together a group of artists and actors and musicians who believe if people are not going to come see what's happening in the coal fields, it's our duty as artists to bring the coal field stories from the front lines to the national stages and tell you the human stories that are often being lost. You know, Bob, I can sit here and spew statistic after statistic, you know, and I constantly do. I try to remind people, of course, that every day three coal miners still die from black lung disease, and my own grandfather suffered from black lung, and that's a tragedy. But I think until you see it on stage and see someone struggling with the realities of poisoned water and a young woman who's pregnant and wondering what the heck am I going to put in my baby bottle, you know, I think often it doesn't have much impact on people. And so that's what we've tried hard now, is to take these stories from the front lines of the coal fields and the front lines from all people dealing with the fallout of the coal industry to places around the country who normally would not want to consider these issues. We'll be appearing in Chicago at the Conway Center on March 19th and 20th, and just continues on throughout the country. Our website is called the coalfreefutureproject.org, and of course my website is jeffbiggers.com.
And is it Jeff Biggers or Jeff R. Biggers?
Either or work.
Oh, okay. Right. I got redirected one day and I was like, what? Well, I hope folks will come out and see the work of art, because it is that, and hear your words. I can't wait to see the play myself. I'm an old theater geek, and it's just driving me crazy that I haven't seen it. So somewhere in the future, I hope to. And Jeff, thank you so much for this half hour that you have spent with us. I hope folks will go to the post about the book at headonradionetwork.com, click on the picture, and go and buy it for themselves, own it. And you know what? I would even go so far as to say, once you have fully digested it, go and talk to people about it, because ending the silence, as you've noted, you know, if people can't come to the coal fields, whether it be Southern Illinois or Appalachia, then by God, we can take these stories to where they are. And if folks becoming aware of this can choose to no longer remain silent about their energy and understand that energy comes from the heart and soul of real human beings, real Americans. Just the same that, you know, hamburger doesn't come from the grocery store. If we can make that connection, then perhaps we can make more progress than we already are in ending mountaintop removal and transitioning toward that coal-free future that you and I both see as necessary and desirous. Jeff Biggers, thank you very, very much for your time this evening.
All right. And thank you so much, Bob, for your work as well. I really appreciate the really informed approach you give to a lot of your listeners. You know, Bob, I'm very hopeful because, you know, here I was in New York City, and you never in your life would have thought that would become a tobacco-free, smoke-free city, would you? And yet it is now. And my attitude is, why, after we recognize the deadly history of tobacco, can we have smoke-free cities, reverse centuries of a cultural tradition of smoking, but we can't envision coal-free cities, which is even more deadly and even more feasible to change? And so that's gives me a lot of inspiration that, you know, just as we've seen the great results in Appalachia and our labor movements and our civil rights movements, dating all the way back to our American Revolution, is that if we believe we can have a coal-free future, I'm sure we're going to have one. And I think it's going to be thanks to a lot of work you're doing, especially in West Virginia. So thanks so much, Bob, and let's stay in touch.
All right. Take care, Jeff. Bye now.
Take care.
That's Jeff Biggers, author of Reckoning at Eagle Creek, The Secret Legacy of Coal in the Heartland, from Nation Books. Again, there is a post regarding the book at headonradionetwork.com. You can click on the post, click on the book, and you will be taken to a place wherein you can order it. This is a book, you know, coal lays in the ground in seams. Geologists talk about seams and beds of coal. One of the things that you will take away from this book is that there are layers, there are cultural layers too. And this book, the genius of it is to show the human dignity, layer upon layer, generation upon generation, that has frankly been run roughshod over by the coal industry, by people who gave not a tinker's damn about the people where the coal was coming from. And yet those self-same people insisted on standing up on their own hind legs and declaring their own basic humanity through it all, through attempts to drive the native peoples away, through attempts to use legal loopholes to enslave African Americans at a time when it otherwise was illegal in the state of Illinois, to the struggles for representation and workers' rights via the union. There were shootouts. There were Old West-style shootouts in southern Illinois, just as there were in southern West Virginia. There is a common legacy of human horror that always goes hand in hand with coal. I know that to an extent it goes with gold, it goes with copper, it goes with zinc, it goes with bauxite. There's a new movement afoot in India to resist a massive bauxite mine that will eliminate a sacred mountain for a tribal people in the Indian subcontinent. Somehow or another, raping the contents of the earth out from under the human beings who live upon it never comes to a good end, except for people whose names are Rockefeller or Peabody or Chase or Morgan or Clark. We talked a little bit about him this past Friday night. And so, while the book is subtitled The Secret Legacy of Coal in the Heartland, in many ways what it really is the secret story of human determination in the heartland. Because it takes a lot to stand up in the face of all of the power that can be accumulated and gathered together and aggregated by the moneyed interests that are always in favor of coal over humans. It takes incredible courage. I feel a certain kinship with Jeff Biggers, because my grandfather died when I was 5 years old. My grandfather died when I was 5 years old, and I didn't get to know him as when I was 10 years old or 15 years old, as God knows I would have cherished to have done. My grandfather died when I was 5 years old of one thing and one thing only: black lung. And it has claimed tens of thousands, over 100,000, and secondarily millions of lives over the generations. And still companies have the nerve to hang signs up that say, "Coal keeps the lights on." Yeah, by God, coal does keep the lights on. It keeps the lights on in funeral homes all across this country. And that is the long and the short of it, and the inescapable truth. It's 14 minutes past the hour. We'll take a little break. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn. You know how to reach the program, 877-443-2366, 877-4-head-on, or on your nickel, 304-658-3333. This is The Horn.
Them lonesome songs. I can't tell by the way I feel that it comes from somewhere around. Got that sweet mountain soul down in my bones. I got that sweet mountain spirit down in my veins, and it blows through my heart like a mountain rain. And no matter where I might go, these hills and hollows are my home. I got that sweet mountain spirit down in my veins. People call me hillbilly. Some people call me mountain man. You can call me Appalachia. Appalachia's what I see. And no matter where I might roam, Appalachia is my home. I got that sweet Appalachia all over me. I got that sweet mountain soul down in my bones.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right.
We do?
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at CityNet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention
$24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit CityNet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
And, of course, if you want to re-listen to the conversation with Jeff, you can always do so over at the archives. WhiteRoseSociety.org/Kincaid.html. Or just go to WhiteRoseSociety.org. And drill down from there. You'll figure it out. It's not terribly complicated. Thanks again to Jeff Biggers for taking time for that conversation. You know, or at least I hope you do know by now, that I don't just ask people onto this program. If someone is on this program, it is because I think that they have something to say, something to offer, and that I think that it is something that you will find interesting. So, with that having been said, I highly recommend to you Jeff Biggers' book, Reckoning at Eagle Creek, The Secret Legacy of Coal in the Heartland, from Nation Books. And you can get it by clicking on the image inside the post over at headonradionetwork.com. We go to the phones. I actually had one of those rare opportunities to find out who's on the line, and it is Janie. Hey, Janie, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well. How about you?
I'm fresh off the boat.
Are you really?
Yes.
You've been back?
But before I want to go into that, I want to say that Elk Point, South Dakota, they're trying to put tar sands there. Do you know about that?
I know about the tar sands. I didn't know about Elk Point, South Dakota, but I will make a point of educating myself. The tar sands are their own special version of hell.
Oh yeah, it's kind of like clean coal. You wash it off in the whatever, and it goes into yeah. You know. I don't need to preach to you. I remember listening to Democracy Now, and they had Hillary Clinton talking about the kingdom. What do you think she was referring to?
The kingdom?
Yeah. I mean, it was something about, I can't remember exactly what it was, but threats were to Israel, and it would also be to the kingdom, and threats would be to blah, blah, blah.
Oh, the kingdom, Saudi Arabia.
Well, yeah, hello, but, I mean, since when do we refer to them as the kingdom?
Since they own our butts.
Well.
Kiss the ring.
Whatever.
Hey, look, you know, if George Bush feels compelled to make smoochy face on the king of Saudi Arabia and walk hand in hand with him through the bluebells, and you know, that's a special relationship.
Yeah, but to outright say the kingdom, I don't know, whatever. All right, so I'm back from Haiti again, and this time it was... Well, I mean, both times it was an incredible experience. This time I actually worked in the ICU, and it was incredibly busy. I mean, like 2 to 3 deaths a day. I went to take a shower on my last day, and I came back and 2 kids were dead. I mean, it was unbelievable, the death this time. Oh, my God.
So you basically closed a loop, Jenny. The first trip, you were working, you were doing some pediatric work, if I recall correctly, and this time through... you were working in ICU among...
the hard cases.
An ICU when I was there last time. I mean, there was a pediatric ICU, and we had a couple of kids there, and a nurse was manning it. But this time, three nurses were manning the ICU. We had a neonatal ICU and a regular pediatric ICU. And I actually got to take care of one of the patients that I had before. I mean, woo! It was awesome. Although I don't think her outcome is going to be so great.
Well, there's a month or so between trips, right? Between your trips.
A couple of weeks.
Oh, okay, a couple of weeks. Is anything changing? Is anything getting better? Is anybody dealing with this with any more aplomb?
Well, the conditions at the compound are improving. They're putting more wood on the shower so you can't, watch your partner take a shower. So I don't know if that's improvement. We are like it as far as like the accommodations. I mean, we are like the hospital. My last day that I was there, I actually got to go out into the city. And oh my God. It is so incredibly sad what's out there. I mean, I saw the palace, I saw where the nurses were crushed, I saw everything in downtown Port-au-Prince. And it was devastating. And the people are just like going on like business as usual. I mean, the spirit of the Haitian people is incredible, especially after the 500 years of hell that they've been put through. I mean, you would think if anyone had a chip on their shoulder, it should be the Haitians, but they were so kind and polite and grateful for us being there. I mean, it was an incredible experience.
I can imagine that it was, Janie, and I imagine it is something that will stay in your psyche for a long, long time. When you saw Port-au-Prince, what is happening there in terms of just debris removal, provision of services? Were you able to get a sense for that sort of thing?
I saw nothing. I met a couple of guys at the UN bar where we would go every night for a hot meal and beer. And they were hired independently by families to recover their lost ones under the debris to have a proper burial. But as far as like on the ground recovery or anything, I didn't see any of that. There was no one. And I saw people sitting under things that made me nervous for them sitting under, like pieces of slabs of cement. They were sitting under them for shade. And I'm like, what if there's an aftershock? You're going to be crushed. I mean, it was incredible. It was incredible. I mean, This is a nightmare, and especially when the rains come, it's going to be a nightmare. It's going to be a health nightmare.
Well, I mean, the rains are coming, are they not?
Yeah, and actually it was supposed to rain every night that I was there, and luckily I had no rain when I was there. And I can't imagine because, I mean, people are bathing and doing laundry and eliminating in the streets. So once the rains come, it's going to be a nightmare.
I don't even like to think about it. It's hard. How do you prepare for that, Janie? Realistically, we're talking about a total breakdown of everything that you and I consider to be civilization. How do you deal for something as prosaic as rain?
I know. I mean, it's unbelievable. I took tons of pictures in the city when I went there. I was in a car and my finger hurt from I was just snapping, snap, 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 whatever I could get. And that just totally did not cover the whole experience. I mean, tent cities went on forever, and apparently at night there's not enough land for them to put up tents, so they block out the streets and put up their tents. I mean, it's so sad.
And now we've doubled down with what's going on in Chile. It's my understanding people can't even get in and out of the Santiago airport. I wonder, Jenny, if we're getting to a point where a broken planet is unable to deal with the parts that break. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I often thought about your little comment about, you know, Mother Nature is getting ready to eject this humanity virus, you know. I mean, it was like, and then the tsunamis were supposed to come with Chile, and I mean, I think Chile is a little bit, they had better infrastructure than Haiti. I mean, I think we're white people. Well, kind of taupe.
Yeah, but more money and less desperation and significantly less poverty. But still, approaching 1,000 dead and entire areas in ruins, and I'm beginning to wonder if, no matter how many people pledge, you know, we stand ready to assist. There's assistance, and then there's fixing, and there's the idea of, you know, that civilizations fall apart, Jenny, when they can no longer rebuild the thing, rebuild from the hands that Mother Nature deals them. And that's what I get a sense of. You know, and it's big things and it's little things. It's Haiti and it's Chile, and it's the fact that Colorado Springs, Colorado can't mow its own grass anymore. Now, I mean,
my heart is with Haiti.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I love Chilean wine and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, I think that the Chileans will be okay. Haiti, on the other hand, is a nightmare. And it needs any resource, tents, everything. We need to send stuff to Haiti. I mean, these people, it's oh my God, it's unbelievable, the state of Port-au-Prince. And that wasn't even the epicenter. The epicenter was Laogan, and they are completely devastated with no supplies. Amy Goodman reported from there, and it still hasn't gotten any better. I mean, there are places in the road. They say that whole houses were swallowed up, and the driver that drove me around Port-au-Prince has gone to Laogan and said that the roads are so jagged that it's difficult to, you know, I mean, they scrape the bottom of the, and he was in an SUV. I mean, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable. I've never seen anything like that in my life. Not that I've, you know, been in a lot of disaster areas, but, and, Sean,
well, we talked the last time you called about things like basic supplies, bandages, you know, tubing, that kind of thing. Is more of that becoming available, or is everything still strained at critical mass there too?
Well, actually, I had pretty much everything I needed. I wanted potassium. I wanted 3% saline. I wanted Lacrolube. Whenever I went to the pharmacist and asked him for those things, he kind of laughed at me. I ended up finding potassium. I ended up finding, you know, things that I needed. I mean, it's very hit or miss. I mean, it's kind of luck of the draw as far as what you can get. We were well-staffed as far as nurses. When we left, we were not well staffed. I mean, they're still continuing to send way more doctors than they need. And fortunately, the doctors that we had this time were willing to do, you know, they were feeding babies, they were changing diapers, they were, you know, I mean, they were acting as nurses. But not all doctors. Oh, I'm a doctor.
Right, right.
Okay. So, I mean, it just kind of depends on who they're sending.
Oh, well, you know, my wife, before we were married, was a nurse, Janie, and we were talking about your previous call, and she said, oh, it just tugs at my heartstrings, everything that I ever planned on being when I was going through nursing school. The urge, the sense that she needs to be there. And, you know, I understand that. But again, I think there's an infrastructure thing that you and I discussed in our last call. There's an infrastructure thing going on whereby hospitals themselves are understaffed enough that it's hard for people to get away. And I don't know what the remedy to that is. Do you have any sort of a, I mean, like you said, way more doctors than nurses, and nurses are what is critically needed. How do you remedy that? I mean, how many, let me ask you this, how many different nations were represented that you were aware of?
I saw India, I saw Nepal, I saw, and this time the airport was totally run by the Haitians, which, God, I prefer chaos, you know, because it took us almost 4 hours to get through security, and people were butting, and it was a nightmare. The last time I went, it was like an hour to get through security, no problem. And, you know, when the U.S. and Canadians were in control, we had to go through the X-ray machine twice, and I have a dive knife. And I had the dive knife in my backpack, and I was actually going to check my backpack and my suitcase. And the lady took the dive knife out of my backpack and said, I need to put it in my suitcase. And I'm like, all right, fine. I had to take my shoes off this time, but I was still able to bring water through. And again, the plane didn't explode.
Thank heaven for small favors.
Yeah. I don't know, Bob. I mean, it's just very sad. The whole situation over there is very, very, very sad.
Well, is it all still, medically speaking, is it all still the triage and prioritization, or is there some sense that that they've gotten to the bottom of the misery and now that they're beginning to treat? I mean, I recognize
No. This is, we are putting Band-Aids on the Hoover Dam that is about to burst, essentially.
Okay, when you say burst, what do you mean?
Well, with the coming rains and the nightmare that is going to follow with that, dengue fever, I had a patient that, we revived a patient that had malaria, and the high count for malaria is 30, and he was 70, and we revived him. He coded, and we revived him for like a half an hour, and we were just getting ready to go out and tell the family that, you know, I'm sorry, your patient died, blah, blah, blah. And then somebody looked over and saw a rhythm on the monitor. And they were taking out the lines and, you know, just trying to box him up and ship him off to the morgue at the far tent on the compound. And somebody noticed a rhythm. So they put the lines back in and brought him back to the ICU, and 3 hours later he died. The last time I was there it was much happier, you know, I mean, not many people died. But this time it was like two or three deaths a day. You know, I mean, I went and took a shower my last day there, and I came back and two kids were dead. I'm like,
how do you deal with that? How do you do that day in and day out?
Well, I don't know. You know, I mean, what do you
I mean,
do?
Is there any sort of, is there any sort of backup support, someone to talk to, counseling, anything like that? Because, you know, you don't have to have bullets flying overhead in order to have something like for something like PTSD to manifest itself. I shudder to think of not just what you, but what hundreds, if not thousands, of other volunteers and caregivers and people running heavy machinery, digging through the rubble, what they've seen, and what will be the psychological sequelae of that.
Well, my hospital does offer a debriefing, and you can go and chit-chat with a psychologist. I've not actually participated in any of that.
And I'm not suggesting that you're in need or anything like that.
No,
but
no.
But I don't see how one can... Of course, in your profession, you work with a certain degree of professional detachment. It has to be there.
It's not so much the death that bothers me, but seeing the city and seeing the people in the city that is more disturbing than the death. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I mean, just the city is in complete shambles. There's rubble everywhere. And people are just bathing in the streets, pissing in the streets. You know, I mean, doing laundry in the streets. I mean, I went to the cathedral that was devastated, and there's people living there, and they're doing laundry with the water that's, you know, I mean, it's just unbelievable, unbelievable. And it's very, 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 very hard to come back home, you know, and...
Because you'd rather just stay and work at it?
Yeah, I kind of want to go back. I mean, initially when I flew into the camp, it was kind of like coming home. And then when I left, I really, it broke my heart to leave. I mean, it was like, God, you know? I don't know, you know, I mean, I've been to third world countries before, but I've never done a medical mission in a third world country, but... This time it was like, it broke my heart to leave. I felt bad that I was leaving.
I can't begin to imagine what you saw or what you experienced, what you lived through, Janie. Your words alone are chilling. And I wonder if it's even, and of course we ask these same questions after Katrina, and we know what the answer was there, because all it takes is one phone call from Kate, who will tell us, you know, she said it time and again, I've been there, it ain't right, it ain't getting right, it's broke, it's busted. And I wonder if the same thing 5 years later is the same story in Haiti.
Well, I was in New Orleans prior to Katrina, and it was during the anniversary of the Louisiana Purchase, and that's pretty much where I learned about Haiti. And I learned the entire history of Haiti. And that was, when I would speak to Haitians, they were amazed that I knew the Haitian history. And they were actually uncomfortable with the things that I was saying, because I was like, we have screwed you people over for 500 years. You know, we didn't acknowledge you as a black independent nation, you know, and several times they would say, are you American? Are you American? And I would say, yeah, I read. You know, I mean, I'm curious. I know about stuff. And they were a little nervous talking to me about that stuff. And over again, they welcomed the exploitation. You know, if the casinos come in, if the sweatshops come in, you know, we can't do this shit by ourselves. And I'm like, oh, you so can. You do not need the IMF. You do not need all these organizations to come in and exploit you. So, I don't know if the Haitian people are resolved to having casinos and sweatshops and all that shit there. I don't know.
Well, you know, you might find this interesting. There is even a Haitian connection In the previous conversation that I had with Jeff Biggers on his monumental work, Reckoning at Eagle Creek, there's even a Haitian connection there, because there were Haitians who came upstream to that area that Jeff is writing about. The exploitation of people from that island seems almost endless, and you wonder. You wonder how you put a break in that system, and I frankly, Janie, I don't know.
I hear ya.
I don't know how you unbreak something that is so thoroughly broken, when you've got international organizations that come in and say, and for instance, Cynthia Black, last night on her program had a story about how the International Monetary Fund came into Greece and said, well, the first thing you got to do is give up all your social programs. You got to eliminate all your, social welfare, or we're not going to give you the money.
Well, it's
when you're dealing with organizations like that, how can a poor country? I mean, we're not Haiti. Come on. Well, just pull yourself, because right wing politics is, well, what's wrong with those people? They just haven't pulled themselves up by their own bootstraps. They need to get with it and have a free market economy and be full bore capitalists, and that'll rising tide lifts all boats.
Yeah, but I think they made a pact with the devil, though, too.
The corporatists damn sure did.
Well, and there's all,
I mean, if the Haitian people ever made a pact with the devil, it's in letting themselves be exploited, like they had any choice, in letting themselves be exploited by colonial corporate interests. Chief among which was, of course, the United States. It's inescapable.
I got a chance to see my pictures that I posted on Facebook the original time. I can't actually post them this time, but they're in. If you go to my profile, it's in Tropical Paradise, and then TP2, TP3, TP4. I posted a ton of photographs. But they're doing mountaintop removal there's like all these places on the mountains that are like complete dirt. And I'm like, that's not right. And I photographed all of them, and I asked somebody about them, and he said that that's where they're doing mining. And I said, oh, is Massey Energy here? He didn't know about Massey Energy.
Well, not necessarily, but the practice will be. That's one of the most important things about ending mountaintop removal, Janie, is the fact that if we do not end it here, it will spread across across the globe like cancer, if it hasn't already. They may well be doing it in Colombia now, for all I know.
You should look at my pictures, because there's tons of that, and there's like dry riverbeds. I don't know if that's rivers or mining. I mean, I have no idea. I was just shooting pictures, but I'm sure that it's no good.
I know.
With everything.
And I suppose is cholera becoming rampant there?
I haven't heard about cholera. It was just malaria and dengue fever that they were worried about.
And that's
probably the rainy season. Cholera will be another one,
Well, dengue fever and malaria are plenty, but yeah. I'm getting an email in from our pal Cindy in the Great Northwest talking about what I said a few minutes ago. You've got to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. And, of course, Cindy says, those people, you can't pull yourself up by the bootstraps if you have no boots. And what you've just witnessed is a society that is... Yeah, and rising tide lifts all boats. That's great for some silk-suited, rep-tied, repig-licking operative in D.C. to say, but what do you do when you ain't got no boat? the people, you know, rising tide lifts all boats, but it drowns those that don't have one.
And I mean, I've been to third world countries, and this is amazing. The devastation, but the people are incredibly amazing. I mean, they are not, the begging actually did not, it was less the second time I went through. And I don't know if the begging is not as bad because they're not used to tourists. I'm not sure what's up with why they don't beg more than like in South America. In South America, they're relentless. You cannot get rid of them. Here, if they beg and you say no, they go away. In South America, no. They keep bugging you and put you in an awkward position and, you know, here, I mean, the people are so polite.
Yeah, I need to stay. I think I need to stay home because I'm the world's softest touch.
yeah, probably.
I get the sense. Well, Jenny, you said you are just off the boat. When did you get home?
I came home Saturday.
Have you been back to work yet?
I'm going Wednesday.
Wow. Well, sometime between now and Wednesday, find a little time to be good to yourself, okay?
I will try.
Do something nice for Jenny and take a deep breath before you dive back in.
Yeah. Well, look at my pictures on Facebook.
I will. I absolutely will.
You know my codes, right? You know how to find me.
Yeah, because I've got the email there.
All right, well, peace, love, and flower power, and thank you for taking my call, and...
You don't have to thank me. That's for me to thank you, Jenny. Take care. We'll talk soon. Thank you for calling.
Anytime.
Bye now. That's Jenny calling from Florida, her second trip to Haiti. Things not getting any better. And that's a hard thing to say. But how can we expect it to get better? It was broken before this happened. Ron and Raleigh noting, hey, Bob, the new Madrid earthquake that struck in the Ohio Valley, Mississippi Valley, too, 1811, 1812, is thought to have been as massive as the Haiti quake. Because it was so long ago, people have forgotten that the area is due for another large quake. The tremors in 2008 were just a hint of what is to come. Construction in the area is not built to seismic standards. The impending disaster is going to make Chile look minor by comparison. Indeed, it may. You know, there was a little rumble up in Chicago. Yeah, the earth is wiggling around. Texas Betsy just sent me a fascinating story coming out of I guess Bloomberg. The earthquake that killed more than 700 people in Chile on February 27th probably shifted the Earth's axis and shortened the day. This, according to NASA, a scientist there. We're talking here about Richard Gross, a geophysicist at NASA's JPL Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. He uses one of those computer models, you know, the ones that the Luddites and the dead from the neck up ties. Computer models, they can't possibly predict anything. Yeah, they kind of can. But Richard Gross says the length of the day should have gotten shorter by 1.26 microseconds. The axis about which the Earth's mass is balanced should have moved by 2.7 milliarc seconds. That's about 8 centimeters. And it's, you know, these are seeming tiny little things. But anyone who has ever seen a ripple in the center of a pond wash up on the edge thereof understands that that ripple is larger when it gets to where it's going than it is when it starts out. Who knows what this means? No, this is not the go buy your freeze-dried food part of the program. But it it bears paying attention to. Yeah, you know those guys are out there.
Hey, I believe Earth's axis has shifted when Flush tells me it has. You know what? I was watching Beck the other day, and he, you know what? I bet you his progressives caused it to shift.
You think I joke?
I don't.
Stupid is the greatest, you know, we talk about dengue fever, we talk about malaria, we talk about cholera. Stupid is the greatest disease humankind has ever faced and has been the cause of more death and more destruction than any other force. You know, in the heyday of science, in the days of the Enlightenment, it's a pity that while they were working on things like gravity, that someone somewhere didn't quantify the power of stupid, because then maybe we could have built machines to protect against it. Because stupid is terminal. When people, well, them Haitians, you know, they just need more of a free market economy. They got the world's ultimate free market economy. So does Somalia. No regulations whatsoever. Just strong men with guns, gun goons. How's that working out? Our buddy Alan reminding me that Drummond Coal Company in Alabama is stripping away the nation of Colombia, killing union leaders. And he says he's been, he spends a lot of time on the road, Alan does. And he says I've been seeing more coal billboards than usual in Pennsylvania as well. And Cindy's saying, you know what to tell a moron when he says he doesn't believe in axis shift, don't you? Tell him to sit and watch the toilet when it flushes and see if it's clockwise or not. I swear he'll do it, or say he does. This was Moran Monday, after all. And there, I don't know, maybe buried in some mountain somewhere, a right-wing think tank has developed a great big Moran ray. And it just scatters out across the nation and makes people say, look your hair. It snowed this winter. It snowed in the wintertime, Marlene. I guess that puts them egg-headed scientists to shame. Glenn Beck and Flush done told me there ain't no such thing as global warming. God wouldn't let it happen. You know, identifying the disease is the first part of the problem. Then you have to work on the cure. Maybe that's what we're doing here at the Horn. Maybe we're working on the cure. So that's the program for tonight, and thank you all very much for joining in. We are off to a flying start for the week. We've got a four-day week here. I will not be on the air Friday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and probably not Thursday of next week, because I'll be off in Washington, D.C., trying to do what little I can to bring an end to mountaintop removal and take a few baby steps toward that just transition, that coal-free future that Jeff Biggers was talking about. It is the first day of a new month. We need your support. We need it badly. We always do, because you're the only reason that this program is on the air, that this network is on the air. That's it. The only reason. There's a PayPal button at HelenRadioNetwork.com. There is a snail mail address there, too, if you prefer not to do the PayPal thing. Thanks to John Fox, to Peter Godbold, to Ben Birch, to Sue, to Lottie, to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, to our blogger, Texas Betsy, our Southeast correspondent is Matt Osborne, Osborne, Inc., OSBORNEINK.com. My head writer is David in Tennessee. The hardest working, bravest people I know are the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColeRiverWind.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome, welcome, welcome. It is a minute or so past the hour here in the, oh, I guess thawing out hills and hollers of wild, wonderful, almost level West by God, Virginia. I'm Bob. We are live. Big show tonight. Big show. No, I'm not going to do the cheesy old, Ed Sullivan. No, not going to do that. But anyway, no, we've got a big show on the, we've got a big show in store this evening. We will be joined later in the program by Jeff Biggers, author of the recently released masterwork, Reckoning at Eagle Creek, Secret History of Coal in the Heartland. I think you're going to enjoy the conversation. I know you're going to enjoy the conversation. Jeff is always a joy to share a discussion with, and in this particular instance, he is, suffice to say that since Reckoning at Eagle Creek turns upon happenings within his homeland, it's been a labor of love. 10 years in the making, if I understand correctly, and we will be talking with Jeff later in the program, so don't go anywhere. What else? Well, you know what else. It's the start of the week. That means that there were right-wingers all over the Sunday babblehead shows. Here a wingnut, there a wingnut, everywhere a wingnut, wingnut. What does that mean? Well, you know what that means. That's right. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Step right up. Get your tickets. Step through. No one will be admitted after the first 5 minutes. It's Moran Monday on the horn. Hurry, hurry, hurry. We have a number of Moran nominees for the evening. And you will not want to miss, no, not even one. Oh, we got lots of Morans. And frankly, there's probably a carryover nominee from Friday. Representative Trent Franks from Arizona. You remember him. Representative Trent Franks from Arizona, who said that black folks would be better off if they were still in human bondage. Yeah, that Trent Franks. Well, there's nothing to make Moran Monday quite like the phony baloney, fake, ginned up, dummied up, faked up, rubed up outrage of the right wing. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean the response. Oh, this is just too good. The response that was generated by the fact that Trent Franks apparently caught a lot of hell for that nasty, nasty business that he showed forth in a in an interview with Mike Stark. You know how it is around here. I get more pitches for right-wing guests than I do for liberal or progressive ones. I do that because the right wing has a massively more sophisticated messaging machine than we can even think about having. But that's just how it is, right? So today I get this wingnut pitch for me to invite onto the program Dr. Alveda C. King, daughter of the late slain civil rights activist Reverend A.D. King, and niece, yeah, she's his niece of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. She's founder of King for America. Don't worry, she's not going to be on the program. She's a mother of six and a doting grandmother. She's a consultant to the Africa Humanitarian Christian Fellowship, a former college professor. And she is all bent out of shape. Headline, African-American leaders are outraged at attacks on Congressman Franks. Really? Really? They are? Funny, I didn't see an interview with Al Sharpton saying that he was outraged by attacks on Congressman Franks. I didn't see anything from Jesse Jackson. I didn't see anything from Dr. Maya Angelou. I didn't see anything from Congressman John Lewis. Mm-mm. No. No, didn't. Didn't see anything from Dick Gregory. Didn't see anything from anyone that one would recognize as a leader in the black community. Nothing from Van Jones. Nothing from Van. But apparently, Dr. Alveda Right Wing King has named herself the leader of the African American community. When U.S. Congressman Trent Franks spoke about communities where over 50% of the abortions performed are on black women, abortion proponents called him a liar, again attempting to divert the attention away from the question of the abortion industry's targeting blacks for abortion. Yeah, targeting. African-American leaders are outraged. I don't see any African-American leaders. Oh, wait. Oh, you're going to love this. Oh, have we got a moron. The civil rights activists did not fight to make lynching safe, legal, and rare. They ended it. We must fight to end the ugliest form of racism, abortion, said Dr. Johnny Hunter of LEARN. This womb lynching, has caused more African-American deaths than the Klan achieved in over 144 years. The truth is being told, and that's what the other side is afraid of. Abortion is the number one killer.